What happens when an artist leans all the way into the cliche? Burnout, heartbreak, and reinvention, and decides to build something real from it. From Jacknoid Paralope, this is That Old Trope, and it's the living, breathing voice of a mission-driven media company being built. It's going to get into my creative process, my personal process. It's going to have everything bared out, flawed truth, blemishes, and all. Beyond the glitzy, wow, what a great company. Inside the, holy heck, how do I do this? How do I become the person I want to be? It's my direct line to you, the listeners. So grab your favorite snack and hitch a ride. New episodes every Thursday.
Jacknoid Paralope is a mission-driven media company. Check out more of our podcasts at jacknoidparalope.com. Jacknoid Paralope!
The essential role of the artist is to be able to see what's unseen.
The role of the artist can vary, but principally I think it's about cultivating the imaginary.
Being a creative puts you back in touch with what it means to be a human. And there's so much in the world right now that kind of seeks to strip us of our humanity.
From Jacknoid Paralope, this is Artist Led, a podcast about artists who have moved beyond the proverbial studio to lead efforts around systems change and community well-being. The first episode of this season, Guides on the Ground, introduced listeners to the key players and concepts surrounding this work and the sector of community development investment. This episode, we'll hear excerpts from a conversation between show host Nathaniel Cresson and Clyde Valentin, a multidisciplinary artist, educator, and cultural producer.
Hey, Clyde.
Good morning, Nathaniel. How are you?
Doing well. How are you, man?
I'm good. I've given this some thought, you know, and I want to provide an example from my own experience, you know, if that's okay, Nathaniel, because it feels like a thread that I want to keep pulling, you know, for us. And I think it is about sort of the future of this work, thinking about founders and culture workers and artists in the community cultural context as, you know, treating them with the same veracity, you know, and enthusiasm and resources as venture capitalists would treat a founder of a new tech company, you know, because I understand one is about making money and it's the market. And I think part of what's missing for us systemically in our society is the value on people and culture, right? And we've, you know, both are needed, both have existed through the history of time in different forms, you know? So we don't have to pretend about that at all. Like that's just a, you know, part of, you know, human society. But where I think we've been skewed a little bit, specifically in the United States, and where we have like an extraordinary opportunity, ultimately, you know, because of, you know, the youngness of our nation, the wealth of our nation, you know, and the extraordinary diversity that exists here, you know, is to just maybe in certain instances, you know, create a different kind of market condition and point of view around how we invest in ourselves and each other to society built, you know, from the ground up, right? So I think about the organization I didn't grow up in, but around that I really have admired. It was an organization in the south side of Brooklyn, Williamsburg, Brooklyn specifically, which is now internationally known. It's a destination. It has some of the high market real estate market values in New York City. This organization was founded in Williamsburg in 1982. It's called El Puente, Puente Center for Peace and Justice. And it was founded by a handful of folks who were interested in very distinct sort of buckets based upon the conditions of the 1980s, early 1980s in New York City, and specifically in the South Side of Williamsburg, which was like rivaled the Bronx in terms of burnt out buildings, you know, drugs and gang infestations, crime and violence. Like, you know, we're not talking about a community that's since been transformed, but, you know, the organizers of El Puente stepped in and said, well, you know, education's important. Art is important. The environment is important, right? So they were all early sort of environmental justice activists, you know, and workers in that space. And all of this leads to leadership. The organization is now well over 40 years old. And personally, I sort of stepped into the world of El Puente through my wife and partner. And she grew up there, right? So through that lens, and, you know, I was someone from the outside looking in, admiring this organization and its work in a community that looked like mine. I think about the generations, and I personally have witnessed the generations of people and families that El Puente, as a nexus in this formerly distressed community, served, and how they completely changed the trajectory of many individuals and thus families, now to a third generation. And I think about what could have happened to a lot of these folks who were maybe, you know, at risk for getting eaten, you know, by the conditions at the time through the late 1980s and certainly through the 1990s, right? When I came of age. And I think about the wealth that's produced, you know, by way of stabilizing families, folks moving from, you know, not being able to speak English to be able to speak English, to be able to take on apprenticeships, to be able to become Teamsters and union workers, to be able to afford a large family. And then, you know, have those children all graduate from college, who are now like cybersecurity engineers and, you know, lawyers and entrepreneurs, programmers, people, you know, folks who work for tech, Google and Microsoft. Like, this is in the span of one generation for me, all emanating from one organization that focused on distinct elements of what was missing in their community, right? So as the real estate game, you know, was beginning to emerge in a place like Williamsburg, right? When they were there and invested in, well before anybody gave a shit about that particular community and its real estate and those buildings and that waterfront property, and they were working to revitalize it, they didn't necessarily take a stake in any hard assets, right? So the concept of ownership or even like purchasing buildings didn't really, you know, manifest because there was no interest in that work. There was interest in, I would say, very important soft assets, right? Which is like people, ultimately, you know, and culture and conditions. So for me, that's part of what's missing. What's required today, and what was required then, and you know, I think folks are coming back around to this in general, is understanding that we also need to factor in and figure in the economic conditions that are around us, and understand these economic systems, not shy away from them if we're going to operate through them, and make them work for ourselves, because that has also been proven through the history of our country.
So if I can echo back what I'm hearing hearing you say is that thinking about community well-being is inherently tied to folks who can think holistically and see what is lacking and think through how to create it. But the impediment so far is that the hard assets, the economic realities, the systems within which kind of like the whole system runs, it's kind of been seen as something separate from that, but it actually has to be integrated in order to foster ongoing well-being and kind of take stake in ownership. Would you say that's kind of like on point?
I'd say so, you know, and if I could double down on that, the thing that I think is also missing for us, and this is translation in two directions, right? And knowledge transfer in two directions. And that is for the investors operating in and around social impact and community development, of which, you know, is part of the marketplace that we're looking to reach out to, probably need more hard data to help, in addition to great storytelling, you know, in addition to tangible examples that you can see, touch, and feel on the ground, you know, need access, I believe, you know, for the economists on their team, hard data, right? And if I had the resources right now, one of the things I would do is hire an economist and just look at an organization like El Puente and attempt to quantify through the generational shifts that they've been able to help foster and create a actual numbers around lives saved, you know, health conditions of their constituents. Like do some hard math around that generational work to see what's been produced.
You've obviously touched on a lot of different industries and built a lot of different communities, face down, similar work or adjacent work, like in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. What is there like a story you can share as to like a moment where a light bulb went off in somebody's eyes when you're talking to them about this work, a moment where you kind of got through? Did it take that data or what, or was there a moment where an investor kind of like got it and was like, yeah, let me work with you. Here's what we need to find out.
I think most recently with my experiences around One Nation, One Project and Arts for Everybody, which was a distinct project that was like arts and health, right? And I would say the transformative moments that I've experienced in and around this project has been from some folks in the healthcare sector who understand, who have valued arts and culture, but really began to see as healthcare providers, the real potential long-term savings around how this work could impact both their clients, but also their employees, their practitioners. But if we sort of apply the same value to that level of output to humans based upon the things that, the conditions that could create it, so folks could generate meaningful lives and purpose, you know, free from, you know, exceptional violence and trauma, you know, which is, you know, too often present in many of our communities, then that to me has a tremendous amount of value and worth.
So in that context, what does that actually look like in terms of them helping foster those outcomes?
You know, for me, what does it look like? I think, you know, ideally, a group or in, you know, a handful of practicing artists from a particular community who are integrated in that place already, who, you know, have some real ideas, let's say, around the revitalization of, you know, a block or a particular neighborhood, who maybe have varying degrees of this kind of understanding, but where there's already distinct value, and this is where the literacy part comes into play, they're completely trusted by the individuals in that community. They've demonstrated vision and the ability to make things happen, right? So not just ideas, right? Because ideas are never the problem at the end of the day. People often are the problem, right? And again, this is just broadly speaking. So being specific, you know, all those boxes are checked in terms of, you know, an individual or group's ability to see and accomplish a thing. So there's demonstrated success, and you could define that very specifically. But I think the other layer that needs to be factored into this work is the sustainability of it, right? And thus the stabilization. Back to the idea of hard and soft assets, this notion of perpetual growth, that our market is going to infinitely grow like this, might be true for some things in the marketplace, but it can't be true for everything. And it is not the only indicator of success, right? It cannot be in a society that relies and functions around people. So it also goes back to and is underlined by that those value propositions that I think also need to be incorporated into the knowledge transfer and literacy building, you know, for both investors and folks on the ground who are interested and serious about this kind of work in their respective communities.
So how do you think you get investors in this kind of work, in this long, impactful work, where it isn't necessarily always going to be one trajectory? How do you get them to understand that profit is the only metric of success here, that it's also about impact, it's also about investing for the long term?
I do think it takes some more work around data and quantifying it, quite frankly. You know, this is about, a market that exists, but we haven't quite defined and helped realize and create some borders around, you know, some parameters around. And I think that that's our challenge right now, that, you know, we have to create some modeling that allows folks in who, you know, have spent decades thinking about this in a very specific way and are well-trained in that regard, but aren't necessarily, you know, who are looking for the tools that they could use potentially, right, to consider investment. I think that factors in timeline. I think that factors in some real quantification around generational impact. I think that factors in the combination of hard and soft assets and what that actually looks like in terms of what's being made.
How would you articulate, and you've touched on this a little bit, but I'm curious how you thought about this answer. How would you articulate the role of the artist, the role of the citizen, and the role of the human?
The role of the artist can vary, but principally, I think it's about, first and foremost, cultivating the imaginary and what is possible, and being able to interpret that through expression in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, multimedia, it's not just theater, art, it's all the things, right? So that sort of level of interpretation of the imaginary, right? And drawing that in. I would say that, you know, artists with a particular practice are uniquely suited in that way. For me, that broadens to the citizens of a place, an active civic engagement, which is another point of deficit for us as a country at this particular moment. You know, we've confused that, right, to mean a few different things. It's also like lacking, because active civic participation really requires, I think, a degree of critical thinking and analysis around the immediate things around you, right, and understanding that in the midst of, you know, individualism, right, and rugged individualism, there's also a neighborhood and a block, you know, and maybe a municipality or a town or a village, and you all have to function together in that regard.
You've already covered a whole bunch. I have a few more questions here that, like, we can speed through, or, like, you know, just tap into whatever speaks to you most. So some of these questions are like, Which components of this work drive your passion? Why is this work important to you? What keeps you moving forward with optimism? How do we heal our communities and realize full potential? And how can investors play a role? So if any of those really jump out at you, we can dive into, those ones.
So why this work is important and how investors can play a role, to me, go hand in hand. And that is, if not this, as one of the possibilities and trajectories to create meaningful and viable change in our community, in our communities, in our society, then what else? What's the alternative, right? Sort of like, what are the ideas? The role that investors play is that we know, given the changes and the shifts that are happening fundamentally in our society today, the disinvestment in federal resources out to communities or out to distinct forms of research, and the increased reliance on privatization of services and so on, we actually need private investors to look at their portfolios and to see what small percentage. So if we took a small percentage of our portfolios, and by that, maybe it's 2%, maybe it's 3%, maybe it's up to 5%. And we started creating a different product pool or investing in a different product pool along these lines. Again, with the data and the metrics that we need to sort of continue to measure returns on investment over the long term, based upon whatever we were able to quantify with some of our research and analysis, then, we're putting something together that doesn't exist and that could rival, other places in the world that have even relied more on government sector support. So I think we need to strengthen and improve upon the private-public mix, because it has to go in that direction, sort of given where we are at the moment. And if we could put not only money, but the resources that go behind potential, so what are you missing as a founder? We're going to make sure that we're filling that in around you or you as a group, so that, you have the best possible chance of success. Because VCs don't sit back. Investors, there's different kinds of investors. There's activists, and then there's the one, so we're talking about, again, different types of investment too, that I think will equip us, with some distinct and growing opportunities to achieve these kinds of transformations that we want to see in our communities over time.
The uncut version of this interview is available on the Jackanoid Paralobe Substack channel. Please take a moment to rate this show, smash that follow button, and leave any thoughts or ideas in the comments. We do read them. If you're hungry for more stories that dwell on the intersection of creativity, community, and social good, visit jackanoidparalobe.com to explore our full catalog of shows. For exclusive access to bonus content, subscriber perks, and advanced looks at new releases, join the Jackanoid Paralobe community on Substack.
To be an actor is a weird, weird thing. One must be both emotionally vulnerable as well as closed off enough to protect one's heart against constant rejection and selling oneself as the product. As an actor myself, I got curious about who it is that's drawn into this life. The newest show from Jackanoid Paralobe, your favorite creativity podcast company, I Have Mono, focuses on conversations with actors about life, the industry, and the words they choose to represent themselves. Tune in at a cadence yet to be determined. Best to follow the show, as well as our flagship show, That Old Trope, which comes out with new episodes every Thursday.